Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our live broadcast. Happy Asalaha Puja. Today is the full moon of Asalaha. Asalaha being one of the months, one of the lunar months in the Indian calendar at the time of the Buddha. This is the full moon of the month of Asalaha. Two full moons after the Buddha's enlightenment. So the Buddha... The Buddha story usually ends, the telling of the Buddha story usually ends on Visakha. Visakha is another month in the lunar year, and on the full moon of Visakha the Buddha became enlightened. Now that's usually where it ends, which is unfortunate because that's really when the story begins. It's only the Buddha's enlightenment is only significant in that he actually taught others, because there were beings who became enlightened but were unable to comprehend the teaching to be able to share it with others in a meaningful way. Buddha, a fully enlightened Buddha, isn't limited in that way. They're able to teach, and they do teach. And so the 45 years after the Buddha's enlightenment are actually the most important. So 49 days after the Buddha became enlightened, he walked from Gaya, Bodh Gaya, which now has become Buddha Gaya, to Sarnath, which is near Varanasi, what is now Varanasi. And he walked, so it took him, it's 2 weeks, approximately, because somewhere around 60 days later, he was in Sarnath, no? He arrived on the full moon, and this is where we get the teaching on the middle way. It's not actually a teaching that is all that predominant in the Buddha's teaching. I mean, we hear so much about it only because it was in the first discourse, but it's gained perhaps overestimated importance in Buddhism, because it's not something the Buddha harped upon or dwelt upon as a regular theme. It was somewhat exceptional in the first discourse, because of course the first discourse was given to the five ascetics who were torturing themselves. I mean, in fact, a lot of the Buddha's teachings were one-sided in terms of talking about craving being the cause of suffering. And that was sort of already understood, even in early Brahman Upanishadic thought. A lot of talk about desire as being problematic. Hinduism today still talks about desire as being a cause of suffering. It was the the path and the truth of suffering that differed, but the because these ascetics were of that bent, you know, they understood that desire was problematic. The path that they chose, and sort of the understanding of what is suffering, was different. Was wrong, and so they were torturing themselves. They were actually creating suffering for themselves. And we do this. We do this in many different ways. People who are who are familiar with the idea that addiction and desire is problematic, they end up torturing themselves, either religiously or not. They'll do it in a secular sense. People spend their lives working, for example, doing the good thing, you know, doing the right thing, helping others, activists, people who are social workers, that kind of thing. They're working for goodness and end up getting burnt out, working too hard, pushing themselves, torturing themselves, thinking that some other's benefit to be had outside of desire. So they understand on the one hand that desire is problematic, they just don't understand how to be free from it. And so as a result, or how to be free from suffering. They don't understand how to be free from desire. They believe that simply working contrary to your desires, giving up, being altruistic, that kind of thing, that this is the way. And so the Buddha found the middle way. And this was the teaching that he had to give to these people who were set upon torturing themselves, religiously in this case. Like actually physically torturing themselves. So he explained to them that just because desire is wrong doesn't mean you can go to the other extreme and cultivate that which is unpleasant, undesirable. He showed them that there was a middle way. It was the way of not non-extreme, the way of not seeking out, of not inclining either to pleasure or to pain. It was a way of tolerance. And patience. Patience is really the best way to understand the middle way. It's a special kind, a special understanding of patience that we don't normally realize. That patience, true patience, doesn't mean simply dealing and bearing with the unpleasant things. But it also means bearing with the pleasant things. When something unpleasant comes, you're patient with it. Insofar as you don't get upset about it. But when something good comes, you're patient with it insofar as you don't leap for it. So when you're truly patient, you're able to experience things without reacting to them. A special kind of patience. Anulomika kanti, it's patience that leads to is in line with truth and leads to enlightenment. So he taught the middle way. This was what he started with, because they were saying, well, you know, you tortured yourself and you couldn't find the truth. You lived a life of pleasure, couldn't find the truth. How could you possibly claim to be enlightened? And they said, well, it's because neither of those works. I tried them both. I lived a life of luxury, it's true. Didn't help. I tortured myself, it's true. I gave it up because it too didn't help. So I found the middle way. I found the way to avoid extremes. And then he taught them the Eightfold Noble Path. And that's sort of a blueprint of Buddhism. The Buddha's teaching is based on these eight factors, and it's a good way to introduce Buddhism, as often is the way people begin to approach Buddhism. Whereas other religions teach what? Belief in God, belief in a prophet, belief in a being, an entity. That's the way. Jesus is the way to God, that kind of thing. Allah is the way to heaven. The Eightfold Noble Path is the way of Buddhism. It's where Buddhism starts and ends. But he didn't explain it actually at first. Although Mahasi Sayadaw talks about this as well, he probably went into detail. But he seems to kind of back off a bit and said, well, you know, let's start from the beginning. We've got this Eightfold Noble Path, but let's understand the context. So then he teaches the Four Noble Truths. He starts with suffering. You know, it's not just the Eightfold Noble Path. The Eightfold Noble Path is in a larger context. The Four Noble Truths, and the Four Noble Truths each have three parts. So you have the truth of suffering, and then you have to understand completely this truth of suffering, that you have to really understand and clearly comprehend suffering, that this is actually the practice. I mean, this is probably the most defining feature of Buddhism, right? This concept of suffering. But what's often missed, I think, by Buddhists more especially, is that the Four Noble Truths is not directly about escaping suffering, although overall it is. The Four Noble Truths is a message that in order to escape suffering, you have to face it. You have to understand it fully, which means you have to focus on it. It's really the most important of the Four Noble Truths is this first one. It defines the object. Defines the object of observation, that you actually do have to focus on suffering, which is a criticism people often level towards Buddhism, but it's true. You have to focus on the problem. You have to focus on what's wrong, what's causing you discomfort, upset. You have to focus on that, and you have to address that. Because it's the only way to give up the second noble truth, which is desire, craving. Craving is the cause of suffering, and what you got to do about that is give it up. The only way you give it up is by seeing the truth of suffering. And that means seeing really that everything is a cause for suffering if you desire it, if you crave it. There's nothing in the world that is worth craving, that can bring you happiness. There's no reason to desire anything, because it can't really bring you happiness. It's impermanent, it's unsatisfying, it's uncontrollable. And as you study the things that are this way, you come to see that they're this way. You study the object of experience, the constituents of experience, and you can see quite clearly that they're impermanent, unsatisfying, uncontrollable, and as a result you give up desire for them. That's the third noble truth. The third noble truth is the freedom from suffering, which comes from the freedom from desire. It's quite simple. And it's to be realized for yourself. It's nirvana. With the freedom from desire, there's a freedom from suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the path, sort of how you go about seeing clearly, how you go about understanding suffering, how you go about this process. And then he gets back to the Eightfold Noble Path. And that's to be cultivated. It's basically the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first discourse of the Buddha. It's a very important one. It's where he really outlines the Eightfold Noble Path, the Four Noble Truths. And he says that this is what was the defining feature of being a Buddha, of being a Buddhist really. That enlightenment in Buddhism is focused on the Four Noble Truths and their tasks. If you complete the task for each of the Four Noble Truths, that's enlightenment in Buddhism. So it's quite clearly a definition of the Buddhist religion, if you will. You know, the teachings of the Buddha, if you want to understand what is the core of it, it's this sutta. It's very good in that way. So that was on the Salha Puja. 5 days later, he gave the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. So that's, today is the Salha Puja. We're celebrating the first discourse. Tomorrow will be entering into the rains. It's the beginning of the new season in the Buddhist calendar, in the Indian calendar at the time. It's the hot season. This is the last day of the hot season, I guess. Tomorrow will be the first day of the rainy season. So tomorrow, I have to move into our new location, officially. And then on the fifth day of the new month, which is 5 days from now, that would be when the Buddha gave the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, which is the second discourse. So, it's a little bit about the Salha Puja, a little bit about the basis of Buddhism, which is, I think, useful. Even for those of us who are familiar with Buddhism, familiar with Salha Puja, going over the Four Noble Truths is always good. Something we should always focus on. Those of you who have not heard these, the story of the Buddha and the story of Asalaha Puja, I think it's quite important. It gives you a sense of focus, because you know, you can study Buddhism, you can read about it, and often you just, you know, skirt around the edges, reading here, reading there, and you never really get a sense, because it's like the blind man and the elephant. If you're blind and you go and look at an elephant, or you just touch its tail, you think, well, the elephant's like a broom. Or if you touch its tusk, you think, well, it's like a pole. If you touch its trunk, and you think it's like a, I don't know, I can't remember what that's, but like an ear, then it's like a winnowing fan, and that kind of thing. When the elephant is so much more. And to really get a sense of the elephant, you really need to be able to grasp the elephantness of it. And the Four Noble Truths are that. They're the essence of Buddhism. The essence of the elephant. Okay, so let's look at some questions. Why is it only when I'm conscious of my stomach rising and falling my lungs start to hurt, because I'm unintentionally... Is this... is this what I've answered? No. I'm unintentionally forcing my breath. I try and let my breath naturally come in, being mindful of rising and falling, but it lacks, and I start yawning because I'm not getting enough oxygen. It's so difficult. I always start my meditation with rising and falling of the stomach, or whatever comes to my attention. Do the rising and falling. It's meant to be difficult. It's meant to be challenging. It's challenging you to stop controlling, to learn to let go, to learn to be flexible. Just keep doing what you're doing. The change will come by itself. Your mind will start to get it. Get the fact that it can't control, can't be in charge, can't force things. Eventually your mind will just let go. It will learn to be flexible, to experience and to interact rather than react and fight with the experience. You're unintentionally forcing, that's the whole point. To be able to see that is such a great thing. It teaches you not only that you're forcing, but that forcing is a real cause of suffering and stress. And when you finally see that, you start to change, start to become disinclined towards forcing things. The fifth precept is, I undertake the training rule to abstain from fermented drink that causes heedlessness. Tea is considered to cause heedlessness. Isn't fermented, but some tea changes your feelings. Yes, but yes, and there's a case there. I understand caffeine, cigarettes, those sorts of things could be considered to be intoxicants, but they're not intoxicants in the same way that alcohol is an intoxicant. If you drink alcohol, there's something quite extreme that goes on, and so it's a very dangerous thing. Coffee, tea, not so dangerous. You want to say it's problematic? I'm with you. I don't take caffeine, not regularly. Sometimes I do, and people give me tea or coffee. But I don't consider it, it's clearly not anything like alcohol. Alcohol poisons your mind, poisons the brain, and really makes it quite difficult to be mindful. So therefore there's a precept against it. It's actually, it's not immoral to drink alcohol. Not in the same way that it's immoral to kill or to steal. And yet it's a precept, because if you have unwholesomeness in your mind, you know, the chances of being able to prevent unwholesomeness from arising, from taking charge, you know, you think of the things you've done when you're drunk. If I think of the things I did when I was drunk, not proud. And in fact, there was one time I remember I was just frustrated. I was young and I fell in with the wrong friendship. You know, there's this other guy who was going around stealing people's alcohol and stealing people's things and bothering them and breaking things and destroying things. And I fell in with him one night, got drunk with him, and we just started doing terrible, terrible things at this party. And I ended up losing, not losing, but damaging many friendships as a result of my actions. You know, we do things that we wouldn't, I was horrified the next morning to realize what an idiot I had been. And you do that when you're drunk. You fall into that. Now, coffee and cigarettes. Probably not going to have the same effect. Problematic? Sure. Good argument. But to say they're the same as alcohol is not really proper. Scrolling. When I see that my cat has a mouse and will likely kill it, how should I react in order for the best karmic outcome? Okay. Should I let the cat kill the mouse? No. Rescue the mouse and leave it to die? Better. Kill the mouse to end its protracted death? No. No, what we don't really understand as people, unless you've done, you know, even if you've done, what we don't understand is that killing is a very, very profound act. We don't get it. It's not clearly evident. Death seems to be like just a moment, you know? It's actually quite peaceful to die, right? Whereas torturing someone is far worse. I agree that torturing someone could be arguably worse karmically, right? It's more prolonged, it's more vicious. Killing can be actually done quite simply. But killing is a very profound act, and you feel it when you do it. I remember driving, far before I was a Buddhist, driving in my father's car and seeing a turtle on the side of the road, and I wanted to pick it up and move it out of the way so it wouldn't get run over. Turns out it had already been run over. Big turtle, I think it was like, well, maybe not that big, but a fairly big turtle. And so I stopped and I saw that its shell was broken and it was hissing at me. I was in great pain. I was dying. I mean, this happens if you live in the country, you see these turtles dead, you know, dead already, but not dead, but, you know, with no hope by the side of the road. They've been run over. And what did I do? I put it under my tire and I ran over it several times, thinking that I was helping. If you've never done that, you don't. Even if you've done it, if you've never really practiced meditation, you can't feel how awful that is. What a horrific thing it is to do. Now, it seems humane. It seems like the right thing to do. You know, it seems like you're putting it out of its misery. We talk about this. I was with a friend once. This was after I was Buddhist, actually. We were talking about killing, and we were debating. And he said once he, really good guy, even to this day, he's, you know, he's always been on a better path than I have. I mean, well, not now, he's not Buddhist, so clearly inferior, but he's still a really good guy. But he always had his head sort of on straight in a way that I never did. He had a moral compass, as they say. And so he was telling me about how he once tried to kill a seagull. He saw a seagull that had been hit by a car. And so he picked up a rock and he was going to try to crush the seagull. And he said he couldn't do it. He felt bad, and he felt bad to that day. After all that time, he still felt horrible that he was unable to kill the seagull. He felt guilty about it, not being able to do it. That's how profound it is to kill. When you actually, you're actually faced with it, you can feel it. It's a really surprisingly profound act, killing. It's really it's part of the universe, because death is significant. I always talk about death not being real, but as far as simple experiences go, it's a very profound one, because of how the human birth is set up. And so I didn't really give him an argument, but it was really interesting, because that day we were on our way to see a friend whose mother had died. And when we got there, the friend and her family were talking about this woman who had died, and how right before she died, she was in really confused throughout her sickness, but right before she died, she suddenly cleared up, and she looked at them, and she maybe even, I can't talk to them, I can't remember, but she looked so lucid and clear. She was suddenly remarkably alert, and then she passed away. It was like she had finally come to terms with her life and was ready to die. That's what a good death is like. You don't measure it by the sickness, you measure it by the last moment, that they've worked out everything they have to work out, everything that was this life, whether the last chapter was actually written and completed. Murder, even with the best of intentions, is breaking that off. It's death halfway through the last chapter. It's confusion, it's fear, it's not complete. It's cutting out, being cut off halfway through, and therefore quite a precarious position to be put in. So when you talk about, you know, stopping a cat from killing a mouse is good for both, really. You know, if you stop the cat from committing that horrible deed, you change the course of its destiny, because after you've killed, it becomes much easier to do it again. It becomes habitual. You're set on a path of greater coarseness. Your mind is more coarse, and you think much less of killing the second time than the third time, and so on. But then when the mouse is half dead and you've prevented the cat from actually doing the killing, you sit there and you wonder whether it's worth allowing it to be tortured. But you see, you haven't done the torturing. The torturing was an awful thing, there's no question. But it's over, it's done with. The question now is, allow the being to deal with the suffering that has already happened, that has already been dealt with. Or break it up halfway through, when the being is still dealing with the suffering and is still unresolved about the suffering, right? So it's still in a state of anguish. To kill the being in its state of anguish, it's highly problematic. What you want to do is to die at peace. The only way to do that when you're in great suffering is to allow the pain and suffering to run its course. Just recently, it's a silly example, but I have this teapot that I drink out of, and I was drinking out of the teapot, and suddenly there was something kind of not water in my mouth, and I don't know how, but I'm still not sure how it happened, but I kind of closed my teeth on it, just lightly, until I realized it wasn't what it was, and I pulled it out of my mouth, and it was a beetle, and it was a black bug, and I had killed it. I hadn't killed it, but I had severely injured it, and I put it down. And there was a sense, you know, oh, it's suffering horribly, this insect, you know. And difficult to watch, you know, to look at this being suffering. And at first it was cringing, but eventually you was watching it. Eventually it calmed down. It entered into a more peaceful state, and it actually walked away eventually. I don't know where it went. It's somewhere in my room. It's dead somewhere, I'm sure, in my room. But, you know, there's nothing, you can't take back the suffering. You can't take back the problem. But when you have a problem, it's very useful and very important for you to deal with it and work it out. Because that's part of life. It's part of samsara. If you're constantly avoiding these things, if you're constantly trying to avoid them, they're just going to cause you more suffering the next time they come around. You're not actually going to escape suffering. So, it's a very important question. It's a very good question. It's the kind of question that should be talked about and should be discussed and analyzed. That's the Buddhist outlook on it, as far as I understand. Recently, while meditating, I have been slowing my in-out and time between breaths down drastically. I've noticed some results quickly. Can this be used to settle into a meditation or ultimately slowing down my progress? If you've read my booklet, you know that that's not how we practice. The slowing down consciously of your breath is creating a artificial state. You know, it's creating a sort of a dichotomy, I guess, of the way it should be and the way it shouldn't be. So you're setting up a specific intention, let it be this way. And as you do that, you lose sight of the uncertainty of reality. You become caught up in the idea of controlling reality and keeping reality in a certain way, which is not really possible. It's something that you do for a while and eventually you give up, and it goes back right back to the way it naturally is, which is uncertain and inconstant. So any kind of trying to control the breath or trying to control anything is very much against the practice of insight meditation. Now, if you just want to calm the mind temporarily, sure, there's lots of things you can do, and that's valid meditation, but it doesn't last. That's the key problem the Buddha said with any of these kind of meditations. They don't last. They're impermanent. It's the true problem with any kind of pleasant and peaceful meditation. And they don't last. Meditation isn't supposed to be peaceful. It's not the true practice. True practice is based on suffering, about learning to deal with difficulty, the problems, so that they no longer they're no longer problematic. How does one go about checking the availability to stay at the Sri Mangala Meditation Center? It's a good question. You don't right now. We don't have a way for you to check availability. I don't know if we want to. We have a calendar, but it's not open to the public. I think, you know, the way we're doing it now is you have to apply. And then we tell you. You apply and we say, we don't have room at that time. Or we say, we have room at that time. And, you know, if you book, it seems right now, if you book 2 months in advance, you're pretty good. And I don't know how the fall is going to be. It could just be a summer thing. But right now we're booked a month and a half in advance, I think. Right now we're booked through August. Through August and into September. It's the best we can do for now. I'm not sure that we want to make the calendar public. Maybe we do. That's something we have to talk about. Anything? I mean, it's got names on it, is the only thing, I guess. Otherwise, we could make it public. Maybe we can give every meditator a code number. We just put numbers on the calendar.
Use initials.
Yeah, but we need to know the names. That's the thing. The benefit of the calendar is for us to look at it and say, oh, this person is coming. And then we can look at their, like Ryan's coming tomorrow. Tomorrow we have a new meditator. Ryan. And I don't even remember who Ryan is, because I only started putting last names, family names on. So I don't know. Best thing is to just apply or contact us and ask about a time, and we'll let you know. We'll book in advance and we're pretty good. There's a week in October that I'm maybe going to be away, so I'm trying to keep it free, but apart from that. And then December, the Christmas holiday, unfortunately I'll probably be with my mother in Florida. When my thoughts arise, is it useful to envision the thoughts as little bubbles rising to the surface, above and away from myself? This is what I've been doing while sitting meditation. No, that's not. If you haven't read my booklet on how to meditate, please do so, and you have to follow that meditation. There's lots of little tricks. Your mind will trick you into doing it all sorts of wrong ways, no, all sorts of different ways. But if you're not doing it as it's taught in the book, you're overcomplicating things. You know, the thoughts are not bubbles. If you're creating bubbles, then you have to say seeing. You're visualizing something, then you have to say to yourself seeing, seeing. You have to correctly remind yourself of the nature of the experience. So if it's thinking, you have to say thinking. If it's thought bubbles, bubbles, you have to say seeing, seeing, when you see bubbles. I'd like to join your community and help open the monastery in Thailand. What's the earliest I could join? It's a problem, because we don't have a monastery in Thailand. We used to, so you may be looking at some old information. I've been in Thailand, I've been in Sri Lanka, I even tried to open something in California, and that was somewhat disastrous, but tried. Now I'm kind of succeeding here. We're kind of succeeding here in Canada. We're renting still, but you know, renting is a good start. Next step, I guess, is to look into eventually getting our own piece of property somewhere. So sorry, but nothing in Thailand. Can the mind experience things outside of oneself? I don't know what you mean. No, not really. You can only experience at the six senses. The six senses are the gates. You know, you can't go outside of those. Still seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. That's all you can experience. It's at the doors of perception. If someone truly does not suffer in life, does this mean he does not need Buddhism, meditation, etc.? That's right. If someone truly does not suffer in life, I suppose that's not even fair, because ordinary people don't suffer all the time. They aren't constantly suffering. In fact, the only real suffering, besides physical suffering, is when you're angry. And we're not always angry. If a person doesn't get angry, it doesn't mean that they're enlightened. You see, you can avoid anger. Not indefinitely, but for a long time. You can practice tranquility meditation and you can have sustained periods where you're never angry, you're never upset, there's no disliking. It's possible. Doesn't mean you're enlightened. So it's not about whether you have suffering in your life. The question is whether you're capable, whether it's possible for suffering to arise for that person. If it's not possible for suffering to arise for a person, if it's not possible for a person to get angry, to dislike something, then they don't need Buddhism. But just because someone isn't suffering now, and that's in a general sense true, if a person is in general happy, it's no indicator that they're going to be happy in the future. It's not a good indicator. It's a possible indicator, but there are many people who have great peace and happiness in their lives who end up suffering in the future because their happiness was based on whatever, based on circumstance, physical circumstance or mental circumstance, but not based on wisdom, not based on freedom. Bante Question. This person's username is Bante Question. I like it. Bante, you mentioned that since your friend wasn't Buddhist, he wasn't on the right path. I assume that was a joke. No, no joke. If a person's not Buddhist, they're not on the right path. Would you say a person can be on the right path while being part of another religion? No. No, it's not possible. I mean, they're just labels, so obviously many Buddhists are on the wrong path. And people who don't call themselves Buddhists might in some way be on the right path. But if you're not following the Buddha's teaching, you're not on the right path. So if someone is Christian, they're on the wrong path. There's something wrong there. Because Jesus isn't the path to God. And God isn't the answer. Heaven isn't eternal. Hell, neither is hell. So the Christian doctrine doesn't hold up to snuff. It's not real. It's not true. Anyone who believes it's true is on the wrong path. It's out of touch and out of line with, out of sync with reality. One. Islam, same. Judaism, you know, what is Judaism? I don't really know. Judaism, the idea that certain rituals are necessary, important, and the right way to live is wrong. It's wrong to believe that because those rituals are not necessary. Abstaining from pork, for example, is not really necessary. But well, some of the rules in Judaism are pretty horrific. Hinduism has a lot about Maya, that this world is just a mirage. It's not true. This world is as real as it gets. There's nothing more real about an underlying reality that is beyond this dream state, according to Hinduism. You know, this is just dreams, basically. And it's all just illusion. It's an interesting philosophy. This is why I like Hinduism better than the Abrahamic religions. I find them to be somewhat simplistic. Even though I know someone was arguing that, Thomas Aquinas, those kind of things, Saint Augustine. These guys were very, very deep thinkers, and there was a lot of, you know, very profound thought going on. It's still a simplistic philosophy. In Hinduism, it's interesting. They got a better argument. They say how they deal with suffering, right? Hinduism, they say, well, it's just a game. Krishna's just playing with us. It's called Krishna Lila. He's just playing a game. I mean, that you can actually get behind. Well, of course, that makes sense. I mean, it's a mess out there. How else do you make sense of it? This isn't the work of an omniscient being. No matter, you can't argue that, even though they do. It's a silly argument. This is the work of a madman. And Hinduism kind of says it. Like, yes, yes, Hindu's just playing games. He's crazy, basically. That's what Krishna is. Still crazy. It's still not the truth. So yeah, outside of Buddhism, there's no right path, right practice. Seems like Buddhism, as it is practiced here, is more of a philosophy rather than a religion. Since you don't really worship a god, would you agree? No, I disagree. And if you know anything about my understanding of the word religion, you know that Buddhism is very much a religion to me. Oh, I missed a question. I missed some talks. Anyway, so we'll go back to them. Religion means taking something seriously. We use the word in a secular sense. He dieted religiously. She exercised religiously. X did Y religiously. Religiously means take something seriously. It means you're not frivolous with it. It's not just a hobby. It's not something you do off the cuff. It's something you really take seriously. I take Buddhism, you know, quite seriously. This is something that is important. So that's religion for me. Religion has nothing to do with God or belief. Worship, faith, that's not what religion means. It's what it means to some people, but it's not really what the word means. It's not where the word comes from. It's not clear where the word comes from, but a really good answer in my mind is it comes from the word religion, religions, as opposed to negligence, the opposite of negligence. Is the meditation course you give at your center similar to the Asan Goenka 10-day Vipassana course given around the US and other places? Not really. It's quite different. We do walking meditation as well, first of all. The Buddha encouraged walking and sitting meditation. The Goenka tradition doesn't do that. So, it's an argument we would make, but it is a distinction. We do walking and sitting meditation. Also, the technique's quite different. And the foundation course takes somewhere around 20 days. We say 21, but usually it doesn't take quite so long. You should read our booklet on how to meditate, and then you'll get a sense of the technique that we practice. There's a link at the top of our meditation page here. What if a person follows Buddhist teachings but has a pantheist view of the world? Well, pantheism is not Buddhism, I don't think. I don't quite know pantheism. Pantheism is the idea that there's lots of gods, right? I mean, gods in Buddhism aren't... It's not theism. There's no worshipping of the gods in Buddhism. So if you're worshipping gods, you're not Buddhist. It's not following Buddhist practice. Would you agree that most religions have created for themselves what I have termed a religious junkyard? Pantheism, the belief or doctrine that God is greater than the universe. No, you're spelling it all weird. What are you really trying to spell here? Panentheism? What the heck is panentheism? Panentheism? Don't you mean pantheism? Panentheism? You spelt it two different ways. Let's look it up for you. I don't think there's such a word as panentheism. Where's my keyboard? I learned something new. I've never heard this word before. The belief or doctrine, I think it meant panentheism or something. Pantheism? But panentheism. The belief or doctrine that God is greater than the universe and includes and interpenetrates it. Oh God, I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. God is just a concept. It's something people created to... because they couldn't cope. They needed a father figure or something bigger, so an explanation. It's such a cop-out. Rather than trying to explain things, you just say God. It's easy. That's why, you know, even many rational individuals can appreciate how easy it is. I can appreciate it. You know, the idea that outside of the universe, it's the only way you could really make sense of the universe. Why, right? It's the only way to answer this question, why? Well, God. It doesn't really answer the question, it just moves the goalposts. Rather than having to explain the universe, you now have to explain God. And you say, well, you can't. And so suddenly, oh, yes. It's just... rather than try to answer the question, just say it's unanswerable. Sometimes after meditating, I get memories, but not past lives or anything esoteric, just memories of myself when I was a child that I forgot. Is there a way to go further? It's not the goal in meditation. It's great that these things are coming up. It means you're starting to come to terms with yourself, with all your memories. But that's all we want to do. We want to let them go. If you had to go back into your memories, there'd be no end, because memories go back as far as you want. There is a way to go back. You know, you can practice remembering more, but it's not really the way of... certainly not the way towards freedom from suffering. Basically, that universe is God. No. I think if you call it something else, you're extrapolating. It's not God, it's just the universe. It is what it is. That's Buddhism. How do you make sense yourself? I don't. Buddhism is atheistic. It's not more panentheistic. Not at all. You don't make sense of the world. Well, you make sense of how it is, not why it is. I think the question why is misguided. To assume that there is a why is an assumption. There's no reason to think that the universe has any meaning. That's our problem. As beings, we look for the why. Buddhism doesn't do that. Buddhism looks at the what, you know, and the how. How to be free from suffering, what is suffering, what is the universe, basically. Doesn't try to look at what's behind the curtain. Behind the curtain is just more what. All right. Well, thank you all. This has been a great session. I'm going to stop it there because it's actually quite hot up here. We don't have the air conditioning on. But wishing you all a happy Buddhist holiday. Tomorrow we won't be broadcasting, I think, because I won't be here. Thursday we will have, today's Tuesday, right? Thursday we will have internet at the new place. So we should have it then. So, wishing you all the best, and see you all soon. Good night.